Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
This episode is brought to you by Atomic Books. Atomic is an independent bookstore full of objects made of paper, vinyl, plastic, and various other actual materials at the edge of time. Specializing in literary comics, small press, art books, and great regional beer at 8 Bar in the back of the store. Come to 3620 Falls Road in Hamden or go to atomicbooks.com. Atomic Books, literary finds for mutated minds.
When I was in Germany a few years ago doing a bass duo with a German bass player, it's about 10, 12 years ago, I took an afternoon nap, which is something I rarely do, and it was a dream. And my father came to me in a dream. And he said, I'm a composer too. And so he gave me these scores, and they were graphic scores with pyramids and things and dots. So I got up immediately and wrote them down. And we played that music that night at the concert.
This is Essential Tremors.
I'm Lee Gardner.
I'm Matt Byers. The idea behind this show is to have musicians and other creators talk about songs that shaped who they are. We're not looking for favorite songs, necessarily. We're also not looking for songs that they'd choose to take with them if they were stranded on a desert island. What we're looking for are songs that have significance to them. Songs that might have changed the course of their creative lives, or their lives in general. Jazz double bassist William Parker has compiled a musical career spanning 5 decades, most prominently with pianist Cecil Taylor, and also through leading his own band and collaborating with dozens of other musicians. A free-thinking, free-playing virtuoso, Parker has turned his instrument into a direct conduit to his unconscious mind, creating sounds that are unique to him alone. In addition to being a prolific recording artist and live performer, he has also published 6 books and served as a teacher and mentor to many younger musicians. The first song Parker chose as being formative for him was Diminuendo and Crescendo in Blue by Duke Ellington.
That was probably the first music I heard that seeped into the interior of my being. My father had a couple of heroes in life, and one of his heroes was Goyal, the Apache chief we call Geronimo. And his other hero was, one of his other heroes was Edward Kennedy Ellington. And we were living in the projects, Melrose Projects in the Bronx. And he'd come home every day from work and he put this cut on, Ellington and Newport. And let's see if we can get the year. That was 1957. I don't know when it came out, but I was under, 52. So I was like 7, 8 years old. And we'd have a we danced to it, my brother and I. And of course, it was every night it was a dance contest leading up to Paul Gonzalez's 27 choruses on tenor saxophone. And so we would just dance and flip over. And at the end of the night, I think we got like a quarter apiece. But we both get it. It wasn't a winner or a loser. But somehow that idea of Duke Ellington was beginning to come into our lives, because Duke Ellington was my father's main man, as they say. Duke at Ellis Place, Duke was wearing a blue suit. He would have us buy us a blue suit. Okay, whatever Duke was wearing on the record cover, he would by hook or crook get us that suit or that hat. And it was interesting because I'm not a personnel keeper with records, but I just listened to the bass on that opening, and that was really that was like a foundation that gets inside you, and that the feeling of joy, of what we call the hallelujah, the shout, and that was. And we didn't have labels or names for anything. We just used to listen to it. Then, say, around 3-4 years after that, my father comes home and he has a trumpet for me. And he says, "This is your instrument." And he gave my brother an alto saxophone. And so you could get lessons at the New York School of Music on 149th Street, Willis Avenue, 3rd Avenue for 75 cents or 50. So I would go for music lessons, and my brother, we would go up to Harlem, and he would study with a saxophone player who we later on called the poor man's Cannonball Adderley. His name was Fats Green. And I didn't think anybody knew who Fats Green was until maybe 2 years ago, and I was talking to saxophone player Don Byron, and he mentioned Fats Green. And I said, "You're the first person ever that mentioned Fats Green," because you know, you start to, these names get in your head, and you start to think, "Is it real?" And then my father used to hang out with a guy named Floyd Brady, who played trombone with Count Basie. He would constantly talk about Floyd. He wasn't playing, but he worked at they used to call him Stumpy, and he worked at the funeral parlor. And so then I started saying, "Does this guy really exist?" Then I looked him up, and lo and behold, Stumpy Floyd Brady did play trombone with Count Basie. So that was falling into place. But now the other marker at that time is our favorite game as kids was playing jam session. And they had a toy company called, what was that toy company? Mattel. And they'd make this gun called the Fanner 50. It was like had a thing you put the bullets in and all that. But we used to take the Fanner 50 and we'd turn them around and we'd pretend like they were trumpets. So our favorite game was jam session. So we would begin to play jam session and we begin to create these characters, these fictional characters. And so I would say, "Yeah, I'm soloing for 3 weeks," and my brother would say, "Oh, I'm soloing for 2 months," and so that was so. And I didn't notice these things until later on. It began to put that came out of listening to Ellington, and then later on when I wrote a record called Raincoat in the River with my Little Huey Orchestra, Creative Orchestra. There was a line in one of the songs called "Guns and the Trumpets." Okay, and then I said, "Okay," so that was made sense in what I was, you know, what I was doing. And then just future forward on that, When I was in Germany a few years ago, doing a bass duo with a German bass player, it's about 10, 12 years ago, I took an afternoon nap, which is something I rarely do, and it was a dream. And my father came to me in a dream, and he said, "I'm a composer too." And so he gave me these scores, and they were graphic scores with pyramids and things and dots. So I got up immediately and wrote them down. And we played that music that night at the concert. Because I never really knew the operation of my father, because we never did talk. The only time we really talked was when this guy, Dick Cavett, had he was a talk show host in the 70s. He had Charles Mingus on the show, and Milt Hinton was in the house band. And so Charles Mingus came on the show without any socks. And then, so my father said, see, Duke would never do that. He would never come on TV without socks. So we had a little discussion about socks. But I was in my period at that time of, it's not what you wear, it's how you live your life. So we had a little talk. So, but other than that, I don't know the entrance of his life in music, because my father came, hitchhiked to New York when he was 12 years old. And I know he's talked about, so why did he hitchhike? He said he saw some white sheets in a cemetery, and he hitchhiked to New York and was staying with my aunt Bessie in Harlem, and they would go to the Savoy Ballroom, and he met my mother at the Savoy Ballroom. And there's a record called Harlem Speaks with a trio in the 10-box set called Migrations, where we do a cut called Harlem with myself and Faye Victor and Jaime Drake. And it talks about that incident, how my father met my mother. So even these little kernels of inspiration would come back around, because anybody familiar with Otto Binger?
Yeah.
You familiar with anybody else? Okay, Otto Binger was a pygmy from the Congo, and he was taken from Africa, and he was put in the Bronx, eventually ended up in the Bronx Zoo in a cage with the monkeys. And I guess he would have still been in there. That practice was sort of, the NAACP said, it's inhuman, you can't put he's a human being. They said, well, he's not a human being, he's an ape. No, he's a human being. So there was this big discussion. But it turned out that he went to the World's Fair in St. Louis. And his friend at that time was Geronimo. So all of these connections were happening. In the meantime, we were listening to, as well as Duke Ellington, we were listening to Count Basie, we were listening to Ben Webster, we were listening to Don Byas, we were listening to Willis Gator Tail Jackson. My father liked saxophone players. And what happened was, because one thing always led to another, it was just at the time, this was like in the 60s, when monaural records, which is one-track records, were being switched over to stereo. So Hearn's Department Store, 149th Street and 3rd Avenue, was selling all the monaural records for $1. So Saturday was record listening day. The music would start about 7 o'clock and it'd play all day long. So around 1 o'clock, it was, here's some money, here's $5, go buy the records. So we would go down to, I keep saying we, that's me and my brother, but we would go down to, or I would go if he couldn't go, to Hearn's Department Store, and they had all the records for sale, very cheap. For 99 cents. So I knew what my father wanted. You know, I'd get him the Far East Suite. And then we started looking over to the left or right. And then we saw these records, these Atlantic records, with Ornette Coleman on the cover. And like, it was one with Ornette Coleman, a big photograph of Ornette Coleman. It was one with Charlie Hayden and Ed Blackwell and Don Cherry and Ornette Coleman. And these guys look weird. No, they did. Because they were like, you know. So the first thing is like, well, I wonder what this sounds like. You know, then there was John Coltrane. So by Ellington, and then we would buy an Ornette Coleman record. Now, nobody told us that you weren't supposed to like it, or it's avant-garde, or it's this, that. So we listened to it, and we were grooving to it. You know, we would listen to it. And in those days, to get into the music, you had to play it loud. And so you play it loud. And then that eventually led to, you know, Sonny Rollins and learning about the music from that point of view. But again, Diminuendo and Crescendo, Diminuendo in Blue and Crescendo in Blue was maybe the jump-off point for where the music had to go and what makes the music work. You see, a lot of people try to codify Ellington. They try to sort of tame Ellington and write the scores this way and that play. But see, Duke, to us, and anybody that listened to him, Duke was a street musician. Okay, Duke did not go to Juilliard or Manhattan School of Music because they didn't let him in there. They didn't teach jazz at that time. And what Duke would do was go by his ear, and if you look in the Bill Russo book of orchestration or any book on orchestration, music orchestration, it might say, okay, you don't voice this instrument with that instrument, or you don't do this. All the don'ts. Now, if you followed all the don'ts, there wouldn't be any Louis Armstrong, there wouldn't be any Eric Dolphy, because all the people that ignored the don'ts became the innovators. The people who followed the instructions didn't innovate anything. They didn't move forward. It wasn't about sort of playing rules. It was about, there are no rules. The only rule is to save the world through your sound. That's the only rule. Your rule has got to work and got to have this. And how you have that pop, that's up to you. You can have space pop. That means you can play one sound, have a space, then play another sound. You can have, like, bebop. There's no space in bebop. Spaces are very short. So you had Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. But what they did within that, I mean, you know, a lot of people slept on Dizzy Gillespie, but Dizzy Gillespie was, check him out if you get a chance. And not just because you're supposed to check him out, because Dizzy Gillespie was playing his stuff. So anyway, so it was very influential on the root reason of playing music, which was to heal people, enlighten people, which is change people's lives, not to follow any kind of rules. Okay, you look at the Jamie Ebersole book, he says, don't play any flatted fifths, don't do this, don't do that, don't solo too long. Now, if you did that, that's why everybody could end up sounding the same, because they're playing, you know, using the same rules. There are no rules. The rule, only rule, again, is to find what you're supposed to be playing and play that music strong and beautiful, and that's your pedagogy. Anything else you can change, you can move around. What we learn is you have to control the narrative, the musical narrative that you're dealing with, and Duke did that, and it was. And then the band he had, if you check out the band, I mean, that band was like, if you see films of the band, it's like, there's, let's just say they all had a good time. And they all, a lot of them carried pistols. And so, but, as Ben Webster said, you know, when Duke would come on, the band would bang. You know, you could be sleep. There's a film of Paul Gonzalez who played the 36 choruses, and he's just sleeping on stage like that. And so, you know, and but that's how it is, because he wrote for the players. And I'll tell you something really else really quick, is that I think you said Marshall Allen's going to be here today. So I did an interview. I have these books called the Conversation Books I've been doing since 2003. And so I interviewed Marshall Allen, and he said, yeah, when I met Sun Ra, you know, I had been trained at the conservatory in Paris, and he speaks about how he played drums with Charlie Parker when he was a young guy, Marshall Allen. And so when he finally got to Chicago and was playing with Sonny, Sun Ra told him to just stand by John Gilmore. Don't play. If you want to play, you can play your oboe and you can play your flute. And then so he said every day, and you can, if you see him, you can ask him about this. This is true. How old is he now?
99.
98, 99?
He'll be 99 in May.
99 in May, okay. Oh, that's okay. I just played with him like about 4 weeks ago, and we played for 3 hours straight. But anyway, to stay focused here. No, because when you're going down a path and you say, okay, now what do you have to do? We want to go from here to there. Okay, just go straight ahead, right? But you go down the path and then there's something over here that's sparkling in the trees you want to look at. There's something rustling over here. There's something growling over there. There's someone saying, can you lend me a dime over here? So you get sidetracked a little bit from the original idea. So what Marshall told me, stay over there and just look at John Gilmore. You can play your oboe and you can play your flute. So after a couple of, you know, period of this, Marshall said to Sun Ra, Sun Ra, there's a whole stack of alto parts there. It's like a whole folder and a box of alto parts. What about those parts? And Sun Ra said, well, those parts were for the other alto player. You don't play the other alto player's parts. We are going to write your parts for you. And that's what he did. So when Sun Ra prepared Marshall Allen's parts for Marshall Allen. When you go see a doctor and they don't, like an herbalist or someone in Chinese medicine, they don't immediately just give you a script of, I have this, you take this. They write a script for you. So it's very personal. And you might have heard me talk about in the past the idea of the origin of music and the muse physician. And you would see the muse physician, you have a stomach ache, and the muse physician or musician would write you out a stomach ache rhythm. And you say, I have a stomach ache. And say, you play this rhythm. Dun, 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 dun. Every day, about an hour a day, and your stomach ache will go away. Now that's personal. You have eyesight trouble. You might play a melody that's for eyesight. Okay, so there's different remedies for different ailments. And when you investigate these things, you'll see that it all rings true according to, you know, how you see it and how it's sort of brought down to you. So that's what Ellington did. Ellington wrote parts for the particular musicians. And so one may ask about Johnny Hodges, who was another person my father loved. you know. And said, well, and so the question would come up, well, why does Johnny Hodges play melodies like that all the time? Bird is like doing this, and Charlie and Johnny Hodges is doing that. Answer: Johnny Hodges is Johnny Hodges, and Bird is Bird. Simple. So everyone has got their own way of playing. Now, if you further investigate Johnny Hodges, and you say, why do you play melodies like this? Or why do you play so beautiful? And he might give you the answer and say, well, I come from the beautiful melody clan. Okay? My grandfather played beautiful melodies. My grandmother played beautiful melodies. My brother played beautiful melodies. And my sister played beautiful melodies. I'm from the beautiful melody clan. Then we have these loud drummers who play loud all the time. They play loud 24/7. You wake them up 3 a.m. and say, come on, let's go play. And you would say, oh, this guy's not going to play loud. 3 a.m, loud. He's playing loud because he comes from the loud clan. And he said, I play loud 24/7.
I think I used to live next to that guy.
There you go. 7 days a week. And he said, well, do you ever play like soft? He says, no. If you want somebody that plays soft, you go over here to that guy over there, and he comes from the soft clan. Well, I want somebody that can play loud and soft. Well, you should go over to that guy. He can play loud, medium, and soft. So we all have our own musical DNA, and that's what's to be followed. We can't codify what somebody does. They kind of have to do what they are supposed to be doing. And that's kind of the missing link in music education, is that we don't, of course, when you get out of music school, you can do anything you want to do. But you're taught, well, you have to do this way, you play it that way, you play it that way. They made a movie about Monk and Barry Harris and, who else was in that movie? They were trying to straighten out Monk. They said, you know, like, well, if Monk went like, dah! They said, oh, he must not have meant to do that. That had to be a mistake, you know. And then I learned a little bit more about Monk from Wilbur Ware. I used to be one of my bass teachers. And so I asked Wilbur, I said, man, when you went to play with Monk, what did he tell you to play? And Wilbur said, he told me to play anything I wanted to play. And so he said, well, what about a key or his chord change? He said, no, he play whatever you want to play. That's very interesting. And so you'll find that all the innovators, again, broke the rules and was more interested in music than rules. Okay. So that was Ellington. And then Ellington followed up with many, many, many suites. He was just a different kind of guy with the way he thought with music, and as should be. So it was an influence. Everything influences us when you're young. Everything influences you because you don't have any reference points. But then you begin to listen to all of this music, and then you begin to respect it in a particular kind of way, and you have to use it something as a guide point or takeoff point for what you might do in the future as a musician. So, and never did I try to, I did one record called The Essence of Ellington. Anybody familiar with that record? Okay. And that was dedicated to my father, because my father was dealing with Duke Ellington's the whole life. And we have Kid Jordan on that, we have Dave Burrell, we have Hamid Drake, and we did, tunes I had written for Ellington, like The Essence of Ellington. We also did some standards by Duke Ellington. But it was never about treating the standards standardly. It was how we hear the music. Because in order to really play Duke Ellington's music, Duke Ellington has to be alive on the bandstand with you. You see? So the person's music is them. You can play the outline, but in order to play the music, you know, you play Monk's music, Monk has got to be there. You have no idea what Thelonious Monk would be doing now. Anybody know what he'd be doing right now? Or Charlie Parker? Or John Coltrane? What kind of music he'd be playing? We don't know. We don't know. And so the idea is to, you listen, you get influenced, you get inspired. And you're dealing with three things: inspiration and imagination. Okay, you get inspired, activate your imagination, and then you're dealing with improvisation. And so there's a few more of those, but that's another kind of class, which is the music class. Anyway, so that's diminuendo, window in blue, and crescendo in blue. That's hard to say.
It is.
Diminuendo.
Paul Gonzalez, ladies and gentlemen.
Can you say that 10 times? Diminuendo, diminuendo, you know?
You know, I have nothing to add.
Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature Expedition through the Park School Woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
Beyond Video is a volunteer-run video library in Baltimore. Basically, an old-school video rental store reimagined with a 21st-century nonprofit twist. Beyond offers nearly 30,000 titles from every region, era, and genre of cinema on DVD, Blu-ray, and VHS. A collection put together by crowdsourcing disc donations from movie lovers like you. With no rental fees or late fees, members get unlimited rentals from the collection for a small monthly donation. Find out more about joining or donating at beyondvideo.org, or when in Baltimore, visit Beyond at 2545 North Howard Street. And for a limited time, new members who mention Essential Tremors when signing up will get an extra month for free. Established in 1996, Royal Books is a seller of rare books and paper specializing in literature, cinema, music, and the arts. From Cassavetes to Ida Lupino, from New Wave to Warhol, you will find an ever-expanding selection of first editions, original film scripts, vintage photographs, posters, and 20th century Americana. Visit us online at royalbooks.com or visit our store on any weekday between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. The second piece of music Parker chose as essential to forming his sensibilities was Complete Communion by Don Cherry.
I would have the opportunity to play with all the musicians on this record, including Gatto Barbieri, which I don't talk about a lot. I did one thing with Gatto up at West End Avenue in the outside, because I was studying with Jimmy Garrison, and he couldn't do a gig, and so he said, "You wanna go do this gig for me?" And because I used to do gigs for Wilbur Ware when he was playing with Sonny Murray, but the first time Jimmy asked me for a gig, to do a gig with him. And then I played with Ed Blackwell with Jameel Moondock a number of times. And of course, Don Cherry I played with at the Five Spot. In 1975, I played at the Five Spot with Don. And then me and Don used to play with a poet, Allen Ginsberg. We did trio gigs with Allen Ginsberg. Allen would play the harmonium, and Don was playing either the little piano or the one of his other instruments. And of course, Henry Grimes, I saw him in 1965 at the Webster Bowling Alley. I was like 13 years old. And we were stopping by there, and he was playing with Arthur Sterling, and forget it, who the drummer is. If you ask me in 10 years, I might forget that Arthur Sterling was on the gig. And he asked me in 15 years, I might forget that I saw Henry. But it was, and then when he came back on the scene, I met him, and I was able to give him an instrument, a bass I had refinished, and with a green finish, I called that bass Olive Oil. So, okay, so I knew the personnel, but when we were listening to music, we always heard Don Ornette Coleman. And at that time, they had not released the Sonny Rollins, Don Cherry, Billy Higgins, either Bob Cranshaw or Henry Grimes records. We heard about Our Man in Jazz, but never had a copy of it. But that was Sonny Rollins' music. So I didn't know what Don Cherry's music was going to sound like. And heard it, and it was like just unworldly, because it had, and one of the reasons that was, it was something unworldly, that means it's heavenly, I guess, is that he had a working band. And this is, in one case, an influence, direct influence on me, the idea of the importance of having a working band and the importance of keep on peeling layers of, what's that fruit, that artichoke?
Yeah.
All right, so like keep peeling an artichoke, but it's a rainbow artichoke. And every time you peel the leaves off of it, there's another tune and there's another rhythm and there's interaction. And because in Ornette Coleman's music, a lot of times the bass player and the drummer, they had a little interreaction, but it was a lot of keeping time. And Ornette was having all the fun, you know, with Don Cherry. And you had to like, but I didn't say you had to do that, because if you listen to Ornette on tenor, very interesting album, and it gets kind of overlooked. And then they said, well, there's a record with Scott LaFaro where he's doing all kinds of things because he chose to do them. So you can do things more than what you think you're supposed to do. But a lot of band leaders, they never tell you what to do. They just say, okay, let's do this tune, let's do that tune, but they never tell you, well, I want this, I want that, I want this, I want that on the tune. It's like, it's always very open, and which is a good thing, because you get to add your sensibility and create your own parts to the music. But this music kind of reminded me of Jimi Hendrix in a way, this complete communion, and it was just, it just spot on, it was changing, it was moving, and very good rapport, because Henry Grimes was a different kind of guy. Okay, he was like I call him in a liner notes for David Murray, Henry Grimes' first record since he came back, I called him a Nelly. Now, in the world of shamans, a Nelly is someone who has these powers, but you can't trace how they got the powers. Because Henry did not learn what he knew how to do in Juilliard. You know, he was coming out of tradition of the bass players at that time, you know, Wilbur Ware and, you know, Abdul Malik. And he just could hear and feel music, because his personality was, Dennis Charles used to tell me, Henry would come to his house and all they did was listen to music all day, and Henry never said a word. And then Cecil Taylor would say, yeah, Henry, he never spoke. He did all his speaking when he played music. And so they're doing a record. Vic Dickerson, Andrew Cyrille are doing a record called Lawrence of Arabia. And so the bass player on it couldn't do it, let's say. So the last minute, they called up Henry Grimes. And Henry arrived at the studio. They were all set up. He unpacks his bass and goes in the bass booth. And he made the music come to life. First time seeing the music, he made it come to life. He was underneath every beat, every nuance. He was dancing. He was underneath the music. Now, so in that level, Henry really, really, really was on it. Every record, if you listen to the ESP period where he's playing, he was playing some textures, some colors, some clusters, but he had a throb going. Okay, so that was, he was a little bit heavier than the other cats. You know, he was a little bit heavier. And he stuck with it. You know, outside is disappearing and coming back. So, but this music from Don was full of colors. And that was Don's sort of formula. I met Don Cherry in 1974, and I was reciting poetry on the street, and he came up behind me, he played his Dusangoni. And so we spent the whole day together. We went up to the Chelsea Hotel where he was staying. We were talking about the Dalai Lama and all this stuff. And it was a little around that brown rice period, if you know brown rice. And so he said, you want to play at the Five Spot? And then as I was leaving, he said, by the way, what instrument do you play? So I said, I play the bass. He said, well, come play with me at the Five Spot. I got the whole week. So I got there a little early, and then he went over these tunes with me. He goes, Stevie Wonder tune, Turkish folk tune, a Indian tune, Ornette Coleman tune, Thelonious Monk tune. And he would just run through them like that and go from one to the other, to the other, to the other, to the other, to the other. He was like a tune encyclopedia. And then again, it was like, well, what do you want me to play? I'll play whatever you want to play. You know, you listen, you respond with sound, and that's how it would work. And Don would come up, when I was playing with Cecil Taylor, he would come to a lot of the gigs, and we get off the bandstand, and he'd pull my leg and says, oh, I wish I could be that free. I wish I could be that free. And so Don was always a supporter and an uplifting person. So that was influence on me of you got to be an uplifting person, you got to be nice to people, you have to be supportive of people, okay? And you can't hold back when you play, okay? It's the only area where you can't be polite, okay? Being polite would be being yourself to the max. And then if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out.
The final piece of music Parker chose as being crucial to him was Conquistador by Cecil Taylor.
So at the Five Spot was I had played with Cecil Taylor at Carnegie Hall in 1974, and sitting out in front many times was Cecil Taylor. And so when I got off the bandstand, Cecil would always say, "I saw you up there, I saw you up there," you know, something like that. And so, but Cecil's main people that he liked, he always mentioned the pianist, Fats Waller, Duke Ellington, Bud Powell, and Monk. Those are the people who he liked. He always used to tell a story about when he was a teenager, they led him into a club, and he sat at the, you know, there and watched, listened to Billie Holiday sing. And so he liked all the, what you call traditional music, but he liked it so much. If you like music enough, you don't try to imitate it. You see, you try to be inspired by it, to find yourself, not imitate it. Okay, you just—that's not the rules of the masters, is to imitate, but to find yourself and to do what you want to do with the music. So, my cousin Leonard—did I talk about him yet? Okay, my cousin Leonard. This is a funny story, man. So there used to be a guy on Verve Records called Creed Taylor, right? And so he would sign his name Creed Taylor. So he came to my house one day, and he had these sleepovers, and he'd always like eat hot dogs in the bed. And so anyway, he started talking about, you got to check out Cecil Taylor. Cecil Taylor. But he was talking about Creed Taylor. But if you looked at the signature, you couldn't tell the difference between Creed and Cecil. So I went down to Stan's record store in 3rd Avenue in the Bronx, and they had this record, Conquistador, Blue Note, and it had Cecil Taylor. So I said, okay. This is, because I saw his name mentioned here and there with Ornette Coleman, with the, you know, people who write about music. So I got this record, Conquistador. And the first grouping of sounds was like a beautiful flower. Oh, it just went right in here, but it was different. It wasn't about keeping time, you know. It was about pulse and creating with sound, not about time. You know, that's when I found out that watches were for keeping time. And music was about something else, it was about sound. And so you first get the idea, it wasn't a note concept, it was a sound concept. And Cecil is, so I did, so eventually we did Conquistador, and I learned about Cecil Taylor and Bill Dixon, who plays, and Bill never liked it when he mentioned that, oh, he's noted for playing a solo on Conquistador. Bill always wanted to be known for his own work, you know, Intents and Purposes, and later on his other work. But Cecil met him in 1973. We played it for George Wein at Carnegie Hall opposite the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. When we played, the audience, I said, what happened to the audience? But I said, oh, they must have, they all go to the bathroom at the same time. I don't know. But we went to play and there was no audience there. But anyway, I met him, and then in 1980, December of 1980, he asked me to join the unit. And I played with him from 1980 till about 1991. Then I returned and played with him again in 2000. And then I played at the Blue Note, was the last gig I did with him. Because I actually, on that gig, he had rehired Henry Grimes. But there was something went down, so I replaced Henry Grimes playing with Cecil on that gig. And then, you know, we stayed in contact and, up until the time that he passed away. So this music was an eye-opener, but again, it was about painting with sound. It was about just sort of thinking about it differently and not expecting anything, but accepting it the way it was.
So you gave Henry Grimes the green bass that he played. I don't know if it's the same one, but he was playing a green bass for you.
Yeah, there's only one of them.
Yeah, he played it here when he played Big Ears for you, Festival of Veterans, a couple of years ago, when he was here.
He loved that. You know, that bass was just a plywood bass I had purchased from somebody. I stripped it and then stained it green. And he had the opportunity to get, like, some old basses that were very old and probably better than olive oil, but he really loved, he wanted olive oil all the way. And so he really loved that instrument. Yeah. And now I think someone said it might be going in the Smithsonian, but I don't know, it's rumors you hear. But it's still around.
This has been Essential Tremors. Essential Tremors is produced by me, Matt Byers, and Lee Gardner. Essential Tremors is distributed by WYPR Baltimore. For more information about Essential Tremors, go to essentialpodcast.com. Thanks for listening.